war. Harris expressed her support for both Israel's right to self-defense and for an end to the suffering in Gaza. Several people in the crowd yelled, "Free Palestine," as Harris spoke, but this section of her speech was also met with loud cheers and applause. And as she accepted the nomination, Vice President Harris made it clear how she saw herself as a different kind of candidate than her opponent.
"Our nation with this election has a precious, fleeting opportunity to move past the bitterness, cynicism, and divisive battles of the past, a chance to chart a new way forward."
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Bienvenidos a todo mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, August 23rd, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. That is at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Twitter by spending the hour with freelance journalist Arturo Dominguez as we explore Elon Musk's relationship with Donald Trump and how he is using Twitter to fund the MAGA movement. And we are also in the middle of WPFW's Summer Place Drive, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective at this hour by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. Our goal at this hour is $500. We had some tremendous positive momentum last week, and we want to continue that this week. You can also make a call to 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to Latino Media Collective when you do so. So once again, we're joined today by freelance writer based in Houston, Texas, Arturo Dominguez. Arturo, it's always fun. Welcome back to the show.
Man, I appreciate you having me as usual. Looking forward to this one.
Yeah, this will be an interesting one because, again, one of the things that have gotten attention this month as it pertains to politics, obviously right now this week, we are in the middle of the Democratic National Convention. So the spotlight is on them right now. But earlier this month, Elon Musk, who's the owner of Tesla and Twitter, which is now called X, but I never call it X. It's Twitter.
Yeah,
to
I don't
me,
either.
Had exactly had this, I would say, of all the bizarre interviews that former President Donald Trump has had, this is by far the most recent. I was actually thinking of playing some clips from that interview, which was on Twitter Spaces, which is this outmoded, ridiculous outlet to have an interview in the first place. But be that as it may, I was actually planning on playing you some clips, some highlights or lowlights from that interview. But the whole thing, including Musk himself, was so incoherent, so babbling, you and I and the audience would be dumber just by hearing it again. It's the usual racist, xenophobic, nonsensical banter that we get from pretty much any Donald Trump interview. But considering that you follow hate groups and hate speech and all these extremist views on social media outlets like Twitter, what are your thoughts on the highlights or the lowlights of Elon Musk's interview with Donald Trump on Twitter earlier this month? What were the first things that caught your attention?
I mean, off the top, it's basically white man grievance. You know what I mean? They're, you know, it's so tough being a white guy these days. I mean, what can I say? It was really tough to stay focused, obviously, and because it was, like you said, it was rambling. And most of it was nonsense. It's all grievance, you know, and Donald Trump rambling. I don't know who's worse. Because, you know, he's bad. When he starts rambling, when he doesn't have a teleprompter, he doesn't make any sense. So at the end of the day, you know, I wrote a piece and I called it Unite the Right 2.0 because of the fact that, you know, you don't really have to go anywhere to find these extremists anymore. They're on Twitter. Elon Musk gave them an open invitation and they're all there. I mean, we're talking the worst of the worst. And some of the people who organized the first Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville are on Twitter. So, and they were all present. You know, you got the Richard Spencers, Nick Fuentes, and some of them are turning on Trump because he's not being extreme enough about Israel and about, quote unquote, the Jews. These guys are something. But instead of having to publicly set something up like they did in Charlottesville and spend money and do all these things and get permits and stuff, they can do it now, you know, on Twitter Spaces. And when you have two big personalities like Elon Musk and Donald Trump, obviously that's who you're going to attract. That's who's really going to listen, aside from journalists. And I knew a ton of journalists who sat in on that for 2.5 hours. I couldn't do it. I couldn't stand in there that long. I logged out, you know, logged back in when I could because, you know, the whole thing crashed at the very beginning.
Exactly. That's the thing that I don't get. Twitter Spaces is the same thing that Ron DeSantis used last year.
Yeah.
When he announced his presidential candidacy. And like you just said, that it crashed. There were all sorts of feedback issues, all sorts of technical audio issues when he did it. So I can't understand why Elon Musk, other than ego, would go back to an outlet that clearly failed from an audio point of view. And like you said, there are some interesting characters that were in on that conversation when it happened. And one of the first names that I saw that I Googled when I looked for images of this interview was Tim Pool. Now, you mentioned some other characters here, some nefarious right-wing characters, but Tim Pool in particular caught my attention because if you recall, when about a year or two ago, when there were hearings with regards to what happened on January 6th, his name was one of the first ones that came up as examples of disinformation and fake news. And so, like you just said, this gives you an idea of sort of the characters who were listening in on this conversation.
You know, like I said, it's because, you know, you have these two personalities who both, one claims to be, or they both claim to be the arbiters of free speech. And Elon Musk is a perfect example. You know, I've got tons of people that I could point to that have been suspended from Twitter for either being pro-Palestine or speaking out against extremist groups and things like that. But then, you know, Elon Musk at the same time boosts, you know, libs of TikTok and Andy Ngo. And, you know, there's so many people that are just, they're fascist. I almost said borderline fascist, but some of them are just straight up fascists. You know, they're racist, they're homophobic, transphobic. And a lot of these people dox what they call, you know, they claim everybody's Antifa, right? And they'll dox them, you know, post their stuff on there. And Elon Musk, and that's a strict violation of Twitter policy. If you post someone's address, like when Pablo posted those Ted Cruz records or the agenda book that he found.
From our last conversation, yeah.
Right. He posted it all without redacting some of his supporters' names and things. And, you know, they took it down because it had the addresses and phone numbers and stuff. But then, you know, when it comes to doxing individuals, people end up getting swatted and stuff like that. Elon Musk lets it happen. So, you know, that's a pretty scary thing. And, you know, I try to mind my P's and Q's. Honestly, I've been doxed before. I'm not really worried about it, but I'd like for it not to happen again. And, you know, I had an issue with Andy, you know, recently, and, you know, he just blocked me, luckily. Cause
really?
Yeah. And it's something, he went after another guy. I know he's a rapper, Awkward, and he was trying to dox him and things like that. And because Awkward was calling his book Nazi propaganda, and I tried to get some of the heat off Awkward, which I couldn't, but, you know, I basically told Andy it is Nazi propaganda, no? And he just blocked me. And it's probably because I put in my profile that I'm an ex-Homeland Security FEMA contractor. And I had said something to Awkward on one of his replies saying, you know, if he comes after me, I'm going to have a field day because I'm a former DHS contractor. And I probably scared him. He probably saw that. That's what I figured. Awkward said the same thing. He probably saw that, freaked him out. I mean, you know, Proud Boys call me a Fed because of that. So a lot of, you know, and it's fine. You know, if the Proud Boys think I'm a Fed, that's cool. They leave me alone. You know, I haven't been trolled by Proud Boys in a long time, ever since they found out I was a former FEMA and Homeland Security contractor. So that works to my benefit, I guess. But yeah, Elon Musk just lets these people have free reign. And as far as free speech goes, that's the only speech that matters on his platform. And I'm kind of hoping that a recent story came out that said about the banks that loaned him all that money, that this is the worst financial whatever situation that they're in since the market crash, the housing market crash in 08 and 09. And like they're looking to collect their whatever $18, $20 billion. And there was talk of them taking over Twitter. And I thought, man, please do. Take it from him. You know what I mean? He owes you guys $20 billion. It's only worth, what, $15 billion, I think, or something? It's not worth nearly what he paid, so.
It just shows the toxic nature of Twitter and what it's become. And we should probably tell the audience who may not be familiar with Andy Ngo sort of his initial claim to fame, because he spread a lot of disinformation, especially in 2020, at the height of the Black Lives Matter movement, especially over out in the Pacific Northwest in Portland, among other places. So this gives the audience, at the very least, a better idea of who this Andy Ngo character is. And like Arturo said, he's one of several characters who was in on this conversation on Twitter Spaces, the Elon Musk interview with Donald Trump earlier this month. Now, you just said it already, but you made the argument that this is sort of like a viral version of the Unite the Right rally or an online version of Charlottesville. And you already stated your case here as to those examples right now. But I want to tell you that earlier this year, there was another event that took place called the Take Our Border Back rally, which attracted some armed and dangerous groups in Texas and various other border states in the Southwest. Around March, I had the pleasure of speaking with Heidi Beirich, who is the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. And she referred to this event as the largest gathering of hate groups since the January 6th insurrection. But this event got little attention at the time. And if you Google this event, especially I think in Time Magazine or Reuters or the AP, they had pictures of pretty much the same type of people that you saw during the January 6th insurrection. So considering this as a frame of reference to what we've discussed thus far, do you see parallels between that event and this Twitter Spaces interview that we've been talking about here.
One of the organizers of the Take Our Border Back convoy, he goes by Oreo Express on Twitter. He was in there. You know, I was trying to find, you know, names just to kind of get an idea. And those guys were something. They made stops in several cities. And, you know, as you know, I was following them. I was like screen recording their live feeds and posting them on Twitter and stuff. And I was kind of laughing at them because when it started, it wasn't a lot of people. In the end, it really wasn't. I mean, it was like maybe a fifth or something of what Unite the Right rally was. But these guys were armed. They were extremely dangerous. They attracted the attention of Active Club out of Southern California, which are, you know, a neo-Nazi group. They were born out of the Rise Above movement that was founded by Robert Rundo. And, you know, that's a whole deal right there. But they're an explicitly white supremacist group. But before Active Club even joined the Take Our Border Back people, because they did have three different places. The one that got the most attention was Texas, but they had to stop it. They had a little rally in Arizona and one in California. And those were small in comparison to Texas. But at some of the stops, especially in parts of Williamson County in Texas, north of Austin, Hays County, south of Austin, they had speakers on stage that were explicit anti-Semites. They were Nazis. They were doing the whole, and Marjorie Taylor Greene has done this without mentioning the Jews directly, but they were saying that, you know, Jews are paying migrants to invade the border, you know, that this is some big conspiracy, part of the whole Browning of America to eliminate the white race. And none of that is true, obviously. But these people believe it. You know, when these guys get out there and they start spreading things like that, like when Marjorie Taylor Greene says it, she talks about non-governmental organizations, NGOs paying other NGOs who pay migrants to come across the border. She is talking about the Jewish people conspiracy theory trying to wipe out white people without mentioning Jewish people. So they buy that and it just spreads. And then it gets to a point where you have armed people at the border thinking Jews are paying, you know, brown people to come to the United States.
Well, now that you framed it that way, let's not also forget that there were a lot of religious fundamentalists who joined these right-wing groups during this event as well. You mentioned Marjorie Taylor Greene. Another religious fundamentalist who took part in this was Sarah Palin, the former governor of Alaska. And the not-so-Christian Ted Nugent also took part in these events. But going back to the pictures I mentioned to you from the AP, they were doing baptisms during these events in the middle of all these people with AR-15s and things like that. They were doing baptisms and making arguments to the effect that it's unchristian to cross the border and things of that nature, just nonsensical stuff. And again, however small these groups may have been in terms of attendance, the fact that there were enough people that they were armed. Again, I agree with Heidi Beirich's opinion that this was the largest armed gathering since January 6th, even though it was spread out throughout several states. It doesn't make it any less dangerous than what we've seen thus far. And it gives you an idea to, you know, the xenophobia is real and the most dangerous of those are already at the border present as well.
Yeah, you know, there was a lot of the armed groups that were using violent rhetoric online, and the Take Our Border Back convoy tried to distance themselves from the people using violent rhetoric, and they did kind of push them out. But what happened there was the people who wanted to confront migrants at gunpoint at the border and get into physical altercations and try to, you know, citizens arrest them and all that stuff, they ended up joining up with the militias who are already at the border. We've talked about how some of them, the mayor of Uvalde, allowed them to work side by side with police down in Uvalde. They work with sheriff's departments, with mayors, with all kinds of stuff, and they try to capture these migrants. And even though Border Patrol tells them that, you know, they can't put their hands physically on a migrant like that, they still do, and they turn them over to state troopers. State troopers don't tell them they can't do that. You know, state troopers treat them like vigilantes, like the vigilantes they think they are. And these people are dangerous, you know, because eventually one of these crazy nut jobs who's using this violent rhetoric online is going to pull a trigger. They talk about constantly just starting to gun down migrants that cross the border. And that's a scary thing, you know, and Border Patrol doesn't do anything to stop them from going down there. You know, they let them film, they let them get in migrants' faces and ask them questions. And, you know, these guys purposely mistranslate what migrants are saying to make it sound like, oh, they're coming here to take our jobs or to take our housing. And see, this is why, you know, this and that. And they try to justify their beliefs by purposely misinterpreting what these migrants are saying. And again, Border Patrol doesn't do anything to stop them from being there. They just tell them, look, legally, you can't put your hands on them. But when you have Texas State Troopers that say, yeah, go for it, that mixed message is gonna end in a tragedy somewhere.
I'm glad that you mentioned Border Patrol here, because even though there weren't any shots fired during this event earlier this year, some of those people actually made a threat to a migrant shelter in Eagle Pass, Texas. As a matter of fact, this is what we brought up with Heidi Byrick earlier this year, that there was a threat not only to this shelter, but to other places as well. And Eagle Pass, Texas, you know better than I do, is quite an interesting place. It's like a lot of border towns, very militarized, but it's not that far from Del Rio, Texas, where about 2 or 3 years ago, we had those images of Border Patrol on horseback using whips on Haitian migrants. And you can imagine in your head all sorts of images, how awful those images were when they came out. It gives an idea to the institutional racism and xenophobia in Border Patrol as well. But I want to go back to a central issue here that I mentioned with regards to this Take Back the Border rally earlier this year, is that it got very little media attention at the time. And it serves as a reminder that one thing that brought me and Arturo into this conversation today was this Twitter Spaces interview between Elon Musk and Donald Trump. And this is what a major social media outlet owned by a right-winger now at this point, a right-wing billionaire, is using this platform for at this present point in time. And it just serves as a reminder that independent media outlets like WPFW don't have those same resources, and in no way, shape, or form whatsoever would ever go down that road and give a platform to these dangerous ideas that could seriously get somebody hurt. And so this is why we have Arturo Dominguez on the show today to discuss these issues, because as I said before, and I cannot stress this enough, that these stories have gone grossly under the radar in the last few months. And again, this was the largest mass gathering of armed groups since the January 6th insurrection. That alone, whether there was violence or not, should give you food for thought that even if Donald Trump were to lose the election in November, that doesn't mean that this xenophobic racist movement is going away or has gone away anytime soon. That's why you need to support the Latino Media Collective and WPFW at this time. Like I said before, our goal at this hour is $500, and it's only possible with your support. If you go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation, you can also call 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM and give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Because again, this movement, this xenophobic right-wing movement, is not going away anytime soon. Speaking of Border Patrol, you remember, Arturo, that about 2 or 3 years ago, that ProPublica actually did an expose on this secret Facebook account of Border Patrol agents saying all sorts of racist, xenophobic right-wing stuff, and even exchanging meme photos of migrants either dying or dead in the state of Texas, among other states, I should mention, and the infamous picture of Oscar and Valeria Martinez, the two migrants, the father and daughter who drowned face first in the Rio Grande River. They were passing out that photo amongst themselves in this secret Facebook group and making all sorts of memes and all sorts of other disgusting comments about these two migrants dying. That hasn't gone away. And as far as I know, nobody's been punished for those actions at all. Those are people that are running the militarized border towns like Eagle Pass. And it's incidents like the harassment of migrants at a migrant shelter in Eagle Pass that basically gets allowed to happen so long as corporate media is looking the other way. But independent media is not looking the other way. But it's only possible with your support if you support the Latino Media Collective at this time. Once again, go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to Latino Media Collective when you do so. We're speaking with Arturo Dominguez, who's a freelance writer based in Houston, Texas. And we're talking about uniting the right on social media. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. Clash, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Reminding everyone that we are in the middle of WPFW Summer Place Drive, so we encourage everyone at this hour to support the Latino Media Collective by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 1-800-222-9739, and if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM, and please give credit to Latino Media Collective when you do so. Our goal at this hour is $500. We had a positive turnout last week, and we're hoping to continue that this week with freelance reporter Arturo Dominguez joining us today as we talk about uniting the right on social media. And that alone should give you reason to support independent media outlets like WPFW, because Arturo, lately the right-wing political plan known as Project 2025 has gotten national attention. When I spoke with Heidi Byrick back in March, very few people were talking about this secret right-wing project that was being pushed by the Heritage Foundation. If implemented, it would include family separation, mass deportations, a proposed overhaul to the Department of Education, potential cuts to federal student aid programs, and other backhanded and, I would argue, open-handed ways to put higher education out of reach for many Latino students. On a national level, this would be a catastrophe. But to a certain degree, considering our previous conversations exclusively on Texas and all the actions taken by Greg Abbott, I would argue that Project 2025 has already been put into practice in a variety of ways in Texas already. And so my question to you is, do you see sort of the same parallels as it pertains to education, mass deportations, and even just plain old fear and xenophobia and all sorts of other bigotry from Greg Abbott himself?
Yeah, you know, I see a direct correlation already. I think most Texans see it. Some are probably afraid to admit it, but, you know, there was some education funding bills last year that didn't pass, and that's because they had school choice in there, and it would take, that would take public school funding and give it to private schools, and Democrats wouldn't let that pass, and Democrats in the House, in the Texas House, didn't let it go through. And the thing that really hurt the most was there was billions of dollars in there for teacher raises and to help schools through some budget issues that they're having. And because it was attached to the quote unquote school choice, it didn't pass. So teachers didn't get that money. They tried to pass a clean bill with just the money for the teacher raises and to help bail out some of these school districts, and it didn't go. So now we have, and this is what would happen if they abolished the Department of Education. We have HISD, Houston Independent School District, who's struggling financially, had to let go of a ton of staff. A lot of families are moving out of the district and going to other districts because the district just can no longer handle it. You know, the district was taken over by the state. You have this guy, Mike Miles, who is heavily invested in private schools. A recent report, I believe it was the Texas Tribune, might have been Texas Monthly, that showed that how a lot of our school funding is going to private school and school choice stuff in other states. And then, you know, you have the school district, the third largest school district just in the state, is just outside of Houston, the Cypress Fairbanks, they call it Cy-Fair, School Independent School District. Is this is just one example, because there are so many in this state, something like 90 school districts that are dealing with budget shortfalls, but the third largest district in the state is down, they're in the hundreds of millions of dollars in budget shortfalls. They had to eliminate like 88 bus routes, school bus routes. Now there's school just started a couple of days ago. There's total chaos with the bus routes. Parents don't know where their kids are supposed to be. Kids are having to cross, you know, major roadways with no crosswalks to get to their bus stop. You know, they had to eliminate a lot of teacher positions, a lot of staffing positions, custodial, you know, across the board. And you're talking about one of the wealthiest districts in the state is struggling worse than some of the poorest districts in the state. And that's because of Republican leadership. They're, you know, we have in the Texas's quote unquote rainy day fund, there's over $20 billion sitting in there, you know, and we have argued many times, this is a rainy day, Hurricane Harvey, you know, all these things. Right now it's a rainy day for schools and for education in Texas. And every time a Republican lawmaker here gets asked about using some, because they keep bragging about having all this surplus, every time they get asked about using that for schools, there's always this runaround, and they never answer the question. And essentially the answer is no. They just use 1,000 words to get there, and they never say no, but it doesn't happen. Nobody's calling for a special session. None of these Republicans who have the power to call for special sessions and things like that are even concerned. They're unbothered. Meanwhile, Abbott has already spent $7, $8 billion on his little border theater. He's got DPS all over the place down there at the border and not patrolling our highways and not investigating.
Operation Lone Star.
Right, Operation Lone Star. It's the biggest joke ever. And he's spending all this money to just turn migrants over to Customs and Border Patrol because he can't do anything else with them. He tried to charge them with criminal trespassing, and that blew up in his face because you charge them with criminal trespassing. Now you can't deport them because they have a pending case in court. So they're either sitting in jail, costing the taxpayer money because you have to feed them and clothe them and house them, or they're forced to stay in the state where Greg Abbott didn't want them to be in the first place. So they quit doing that. You know, now they just turn them over to Border Patrol, and it's a huge waste of resources. You see our National Guard, and the most work they've ever done was lay out concertina wire. You know, they stand around. They don't do anything. They're there to just scare people with their guns and stuff. So, yeah, this whole Project 2025, it's been happening. You know, in Congress, I did an article a while back because when they were trying to pass all the appropriations bills for defense spending and things like that, there was a lot of Republicans that were trying to add in little addendums and all this stuff. And the way what they were doing was they were trying to eliminate funding for certain jobs, certain offices, certain programs. And these were all part of Project 2025. So they basically, what they were trying to do is lay the groundwork for when Trump gets in office, it just makes his job implementing Project 2025 that much easier.
See, this is why I wanted to talk to you about this, because Project 2025 on a national level is speculative at best, but in Texas, a lot of it has already been put into practice as far as militarization of the border and the criminal, criminalization and dehumanizing of migrants and people of color in general. You know, that's Project 2025 in Texas alone. And even then, we haven't even begun to talk about the religious zealotry behind it as far as LGBTQ rights, as far as women's rights as well. I mean, it's quite a scary proposition. And by the way, the people behind this, the Heritage Foundation, have openly, you know, admitted to a certain degree that they're getting their cues or have gotten influence with regards to Project 25 from Hungary, from the authoritarianism of Viktor Orban in Hungary. But you said something very important here, that a lot of this, from a layman's point of view, looks like a waste of money, a tremendous waste of money, unless you want to give money to defense contractors, to the prison industrial complex, and divert money away from public education. You know, maybe to certain people, that's not a waste of money. But for the general public, that's a catastrophic waste of money. And again, I want to stress this again. We had this conversation back in March of this year. And I wasn't alone here on WPFW with regards to pointing out that this Project 2025 thing should be taken a lot more serious than people realize. And that shows the importance and the value of independent media outlets like WPFW. And this is why we have place drives like these, in order to continue to give people not only the outlet, but the creativity to find these stories before they even become stories in corporate media. It's only been in the last few weeks that CNN and MSNBC have mentioned Project 2025 and have held people related to Trump to the fire, however weak it may be, to this issue of Project 2025. Independent media outlets were already ahead of this months before. And this is why we need your support, and this is why we need some funding. If you go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation, you can also call 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Every little bit counts in small amounts, even if you just want to be a sustainer for $15, $25, $35 a month. It goes a long way to the long-term sustainability of shows like the Latino Media Collective, so we could continue having fantastic voices like Arturo Dominguez on the show. So, Arturo, going back to the Elon Musk interview, we have to remind the audience that Musk has a Tesla plant in Texas, and Trump's comments on firing striking workers got the attention of the United Auto Workers Union, because it's illegal to threaten to fire striking workers in the United States, whether it be the UAW or any other union or any other group of workers for that matter. But prior to this Twitter interview, Musk has been openly anti-union, and his plant in Texas does not have a union. On top of all this, Musk has created a super PAC specifically to support Trump in the millions of dollars. So this platform called Twitter is now funneling money to support a super PAC for Trump's reelection bid. Those millions are not coming from Musk, the individual, but rather from the profits made from companies like Tesla and Twitter. And by the way, he's not paying taxes with all this as well. So what do you make of this particular form of money in politics? Because obviously, we've been discussing that having Trump back on Twitter and being interviewed by Elon Musk and saying all sorts of racist, xenophobic, psychobabble on Twitter is one thing. The fact that taxpayers are paying for all of that in the process is also problematic as well.
Yeah, you know, Elon Musk gets most of his funding from the government. You know, he bought Tesla, you know, he didn't create it. He's not the genius behind it. But he has the right people in place and enough money to have them go out and get, you know, all the tax breaks and things like that that help, because it's technically a green company. You know, it's moving in, there's grants and, you know, programs in the billions of dollars for green programs, electric cars. That's why a lot of the other automotive manufacturers are getting into the game too, because there's money to be made from the government. It's corporate socialism. You know, his SpaceX program is using, you know, even Tesla uses open source tech that came from NASA. A lot of his stuff is stuff that NASA may or may not use. So some of the research that goes into those rockets are funded by government grants as well. You know, his move to Texas, you know, he's getting all kinds of tax breaks from Abbott and the government. And the reason why he's moving things here is because they enticed him with tax breaks. So, you know, right wingers were all, you know, cheering it on. You know, they love Elon Musk because he's, you know, a far right weirdo. And for the record, I want to say I was calling Republicans weirdos on this show months before Tim Walz did. Okay. He stole that from me. Anyway, but yeah, he's definitely a weirdo, you know, like he's just I wouldn't say an enigma because he's really not. He's another far right crazy with billions of dollars. He's the richest man in the world. And that's the scariest part about him. He was at the front of the line to try to overthrow the Venezuelan government. And even before we heard what the results of the election were, he was calling for, you know, violence and this and trying to get the military to turn on Maduro and things like that. And, you know, you know, a guy with that kind of clout, with that kind of power, who boosts his own message to hundreds of millions of people, because whether you follow him or not, you're going to see his stuff. And, you know, if you try to block him at some point in time, you're going to see that somehow he's not blocked anymore. So it's crazy. And the way the algorithm is set up, it's set up to push far right narratives and to suppress anything other than that.
Yeah, it's gotten so bad that even I, you know, just to pull back the curtain, I'm even starting to question myself, you know, the use of Twitter for a program like WPFW, because lately, especially since Elon Musk took over Twitter, it's gotten so toxic. It's gotten so counterproductive to everything that small independent media outlets try to do. And the other thing that sort of underlines this, and you also mentioned this already, the idea of corporate socialism. I mean, like I said before, this super PAC that Musk created to support Trump is not coming from his money, his personal bank account, but rather from taxpayer money. And that includes people who use Twitter and people who use Tesla products. And so the question has to be asked, how is all this funding even allowed to begin with? And that is a question that corporate media will not ask, because if they were to do so, it would also call into question their own business model in the process as well. And so this is the challenge that independent media outlets like WPFW have to face day after day after day, so long as all these social media outlets are being distorted and warped to the point where it's become counterproductive. And it's only possible to keep these independent media outlets like the Latino Media Collective and WPFW going with your support, with direct audience support at the grassroots level. So again, go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You'll also call 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFW. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. So now that I thought about it, you know, let me throw the question to you then. You know, how is this all possible with taxpayer money to have Donald Trump, especially after the January 6th insurrection, back on Twitter and have this conversation and have all sorts of people do this virtual Unite the Right type of rally on Twitter? It's a far cry from what it used to be. The obvious answer is Elon Musk allowing him back as well and having control of such a powerful social media outlet. But again, the question that corporate media won't ask is, how is this possible with taxpayer money?
It's an interesting anomaly because I believe it's because, you know, Tesla and they're publicly traded companies, right? I'm not exactly sure how the structure of SpaceX is set up, but with Tesla, it's, you know, you have shareholders, you have a board, and then you have one guy who's running his mouth. Is that enough to take their grants away? Probably not, you know, because they would cripple the company. They would, you know, and the backlash from that would be tremendous, right? So if you took away any grant funding that SpaceX had because of his rhetoric, then you could technically argue that this is government censorship, right? That they don't like what he's saying, so they're going to take his money. And the First Amendment protects you from being censored by the federal government. So I think that he knows this. I think that if it does backfire in his face, he knows how to take it to court. He knows what court to take it to, you know.
And he has the money to do it.
Right, and he has the money to do it, you know. So with Elon Musk, you know, most corporate guys aren't going to run their mouth like that because, you know, it would destroy their corporation. You know, the CEO of Kellogg's isn't going to start sounding like a Nazi, right? Because, you know, people could buy a cereal. Well, I mean, he kind of did, but he didn't go that far. You know, he said people should eat more cereal if they don't have enough money to buy groceries, but they don't go that far. You know, corporate guys have always said stupid stuff like Kellogg's did. And
or Goya.
Or Goya, for that matter, right. And they express their political leanings and things like that, but, you know, they're not at risk of losing government funding. They're more at risk of actually to so-called, quote-unquote, free market. So if people stop buying their product because they're open Nazis, then they're in trouble. And then they have to answer to shareholders, and then they have to answer to, you know, a lot of other things. But with Elon Musk, it's a whole different ballgame. And, right, you know, the banks that loaned him the money, the Saudis that gave him money, they don't care. You know, they just want their money back at this point. They want out of the deal. They've been holding on to close to $20 billion of debt. It's affecting their bottom line. So there's talk of maybe them taking over Twitter. And, you know, I hate banks and I hate corporations, but I welcome that. I welcome it.
With Tesla, we'll see. Because let's not forget that none of the Tesla plants are unionized. Elon Musk has been very open about not being pro-union. And that's what got him in hot water with the United Auto Workers Union by threatening to fire workers if they went on strike. And let's not forget that in the case of Texas, where he has a plant down there, there's been record heat waves, not only this year, but last year. Greg Abbott infamously passed an ordinance last year to prevent water breaks for construction workers. Who's to say that that won't extend to auto workers in one of these Tesla plants? In fact, the Texas Tribune that you mentioned earlier also did a report some time ago about workers dying at Tesla plants because of the harsh working conditions, especially in the summer months in Texas. And so this is the person that's running one of the most powerful social media outlets in the world. Keep that in mind. And it just gives you an idea of the uphill challenge with regards to the Latino Media Collective and WPFW in raising these kind of issues and keeping these kind of issues alive. Like I said before, Project 2025 was on nobody's radar for months beginning of the year, but only through the Latino Media Collective and other similar public affairs program on WPFW kept the story going, tried to raise awareness, tried to raise a sense of urgency as to how problematic and how undemocratic and how fascist, let's just say it for what it is, how fascist this Project 2025 is. And it's only corporate media now that's playing catch up to independent media. And so again, it's only possible with your support if you go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFW. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Real quickly, Arturo, because I want to promote your work as best as I can, but as an example of sort of the stories that get lost under the radar, I know that on your Substack page that you mentioned a story about this hate crime that took place in Nebraska. So sort of as a sneak preview, can you tell us a little bit more about this and why it's important to everything that we've discussed so far in this conversation?
Well, you know, this one was a bit of a heartbreaker. Luckily, no one died. Let me start by saying that. But there's old white guy, I believe he was 74. He had neighbors from Honduras, big family, and he would harass them constantly about speak English and, you know, go back to where you came from. And, you know, the police had come out there several times and talked to them, and the family never wanted to file charges on the guy. They tried to show, you know, good faith. They tried to show that, you know, hey, we're good neighbors, we're good people. And they always tried to be somewhat welcoming of the guy, but he was just so violent in his language toward them. And one day he just loaded a shotgun and started shooting from inside his house. And ended up shooting, you know, 5 or 6 of them. 3 were children. 5 initially went to the hospital. None of them were in critical condition. And then about an hour later, after, you know, police were there and investigating, they realized that a 6th person had been shot, and they ended up taking them to the hospital. The guy ended up shooting himself and killing himself. So this is precisely the violent language, what violent language does. You know, everything from the Take Our Border Back people to the, you know, Elon Musk Trump interview, the Unite Direct 2.0 is what I keep calling it, to the stuff that Elon Musk lets go on social media. Like I said, they're no longer on Telegram or on other obscure platforms where that message isn't being seen by masses. Now they're on Twitter and hundreds of millions of people see what they say because Elon Musk boosts it. So, you know, there's a lot of Proud Boys and stuff. I mean, this goes on every day where they're at drag queen story hours, or they go to a drag event, or they're harassing people at a drag club. And all of this comes from libs of TikTok and the rhetoric they put out there and the stuff that Elon Musk says and all this stuff. And it goes unchallenged for the most part, because even if you try to challenge Elon Musk, there's so much noise on Twitter, so much far-right noise, that if I were to get in his replies and try to call him out on something, it's going to the bottom within seconds, because all the people that are singing his praises are just flooding his replies. So, you know, it's almost pointless. And if you write something to counter him, he's not going to care. And mainstream media looks the other way. You know, this is the whole Trump effect from 2016. They want to talk about how much he's lying, but not talk about how much of his speech is going to lead to another El Paso until El Paso happens. So, you know, they want to feign outrage. And this is what makes me so mad about corporate media, is they want to act like this is just outrageous that this guy did a mass killing in a Walmart. And it's like, dude, you promoted Donald Trump saying it and never called it out. You're more worried about him lying than you are about him inciting someone to commit mass murder. So, you know, the Democrat strategy right now is proving that the best way to put an end to that is to drown Trump out. Kamala Harris is probably the best thing to happen to the Democratic Party since Barack Obama. And because of all the noise that's surrounding her and all the positive vibes that are coming off of her, you know, for Democrats, it's drowning Donald Trump out. And he doesn't know how to account for it. He's going back to 2016. He's back on Twitter. He hired Lewandowski. You know, he's got some of the same.
Corey Lewandowski.
Yeah, he's got some of them coming back. He's going back to the 2016 strategy because 2020 didn't work. 2016 did. And now he's finding himself in a position where he doesn't know how to counter Kamala Harris. And the reason why Kamala Harris is so popular is because her message counters Donald Trump. There's no grievance with Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris is spreading, we're going to do this, we're going to make this happen, you know, this, and it's all positive. Whereas Donald Trump and Republicans, or women shouldn't be president because that's a man's job. That's the message they're putting out there. It's grievance, and people are tired of it.
White grievance. Yeah. And however flawed a candidate Kamala Harris is, it's
right,
a far cry from what we've seen from Trump and from people who give him a platform like Elon Musk. And so to the WPFW audience, Arturo Dominguez is a freelance writer who monitors these sorts of hate groups and individuals in social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook and others even more below the margins. And if you want to continue to hear fantastic stories like Arturo and his insights to this, I would say, intellectual dark web, it's only possible with your support. So we encourage everyone to go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. So Arturo Dominguez, as always, it's an honor and a pleasure and fun. Thank you for being on the show with us today.
Again, man, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure. You never have to ask me twice to come on the show.
Absolutely. You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to encourage everyone to continue donating to the Latino Media Collective and WPFW at WPFWFM.org. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM and give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. With that said, that is it for today's show. I want to thank everyone again for supporting and listening to the Latino Media Collective. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, August 23rd. Here are some headlines. History was made last night when Vice President Kamala Harris accepted the Democratic Party's nomination for president, the first Black woman and person of South Asian descent to do so. In accepting the nomination, Harris made the most important speech of her political career. She had to connect with those who are either undecided about her or those already on her side but not sold on voting. Harris told the country where she comes from and where she wants to take it, while also contrasting herself with Donald Trump. Harris painted herself as a regular blue-collar kid who understands the needs of people and the value of hard work and discipline. She described Donald Trump as a candidate who would use the immense powers of the presidency of the United States only to serve himself. And in addressing what is a divisive issue for Democrats, Harris expressed her support for both Israel's right to self-defense, and for an end to the suffering in Gaza, reiterating that she and President Biden were working toward a ceasefire, quote, such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination, close quote. Several people in the crowd yelled Free Palestine as Harris spoke, but this section of her speech was also met with loud cheers and applause. In other news, a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal is now in sight. The United States envoy to the United Nations has told the UN Security Council as a new round of talks begins in Cairo. Speaking before the council, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield called on Hamas to accept a bridging proposal put forward by the United States that appears to differ from a previous proposal adopted by the United Nations Security Council and agreed to by the Palestinian group. The remarks by Thomas-Greenfield continued a trend of U.S. officials claiming that Israel has agreed to a deal that Hamas has yet to accept, despite indications that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence on Israel retaining strips of territory inside Gaza is the primary obstacle to a deal. And the Supreme Court yesterday partly granted a request from the Republican National Committee to make Arizona enforce measures requiring people to show proof of U.S. citizenship when registering to vote. The justices in a 5-4 ruling agreed to reinstate the provision after a federal judge blocked it in response to legal challenges by the Biden administration and advocacy groups. The ruling came just ahead of Arizona's ballot printing deadline, enabling the provision to go into effect for this year's elections, when Arizona is expected to be a critical swing state in the presidential race. And it comes amid a growing GOP push for voters to show proof of their U.S. citizenship when signing up to cast a ballot in federal elections, which many election experts mourn could make voting more difficult. Could make voting more difficult for many eligible voters.